Welcome to the Aspiring Mormon Woman podcast. Aspiring Mormon Woman is a nonprofit dedicated to supporting the educational and professional goals of LDS women. You can find us at aspiringmormonwoman.org or on Facebook.
Hello, and welcome to the Aspiring Mormon Women podcast. I'm Ryan, one of the board members here at Aspiring Mormon Women and the host of today's podcast. And we're coming to you from Washington, D.C. Why Washington, D.C.? Well, first, I'm here on a business trip. And more importantly, this is the home of Martha Stimson, a labor economist and one of our longtime mentors at Aspiring Mormon Women. And we thought we'd take this opportunity to discuss one of the more read blog posts on Aspiring Mormon Women entitled Three Economic Reasons to Teach Your Daughter to Aspire, which basically talks about some of the very large labor market changes that are going on around us and how this might make us think about how to see our daughter's educational career aspirations. So what better subject for a couple of labor market nerds to talk about than this? Martha, why don't you introduce yourself and we'll go from there.
My name is Martha Stinson. I live in the Washington, D.C. area, and I have a PhD in economics from Cornell University. I also study the labor market. I work for the U.S. Census Bureau, and I collect data on the labor market and analyze that data. I'm not here in my professional capacity as a government employee. What I say here tonight is my own personal opinions. Certainly my experience has been shaped by looking at lots of labor market data over the last 15 years I've worked for the government. I'm also a mom of two kids. I have a son and a daughter who's 8. And I guess I would describe myself as the daughter of a woman who aspired. And that's had a huge impact on my life. And it's definitely made me think about what I want to pass on to my daughter.
And I met Martha at Cornell, where I was studying in the Industrial and Labor Relations School. And I started to think quite a bit about the relationship between people and their jobs and the social contract that organizations make when they work. I went on to get my PhD at MIT in economic sociology, where I also focused on the labor market and human resource management practices. So I think that qualifies us both as being kind of labor market nerds. And the impetus of this post, though, came from more my personal life. Like Martha, I have children, and specifically, I have 2 boys and 2 daughters, and my daughters are now 10 and 8. And as the older they get, the more, as a parent, I have been thinking about and worried about what I can do and how I want to shape their expectations of work, how they think about work and their education. And even though they're quite young, I feel this is just very important. And it is this that led me to write the original post, trying to marry my world as a parent with my kind of professional world about thinking about all these big labor market changes. You can read the article by just clicking on the link below, but let me just give a quick recap of what it says, and then we'll start discussing from there. So the basic idea behind the article is that there are 3 major trends that have been worrying me about what's going on in the labor market. One of those is the increasing inequality that we see in the labor market. In other words, there seem to be an increasingly small number of very, very good jobs and an increasingly large number of jobs that are having difficulty in financially sustaining a family. The second trend that we talk about is how risk has been moved from institutions and organizations and has been increasingly been placed on individuals and families. So beyond just the level of income that one might have, it's thinking about the uncertainty about that income and how we've seen some major trends that have shifted that away from organizations onto individuals. And the third one is a somewhat more positive trend, though a fairly complicated one, where we are seeing the rise of more flexible type work arrangements, whether that is flex time, whether that is the ability to drop in and out of the labor market and maintain a professional career, or it could be job sharing, it could be a variety of these other things that are going on, and that may bode well for someone who wants to balance work and family over their career. But there's always a catch, and the catch right now is that those types of arrangements are basically available for the highest echelon of jobs. So if you have a good track record, if you have a really good education, people are being able to manage their careers, but without those things, there isn't a lot of options for people to do that. So those are the three that we discussed, and now we want to go to each of those a little bit more in depth. Maybe we'll talk about a few other ones that we're worried about, and let's get started.
Yeah, so it's certainly clearly documented trends that most of the increases in earnings over the last 10, 15 years, and arguable when exactly it started, but recently, unequivocally, have gone to a very small percentage of people at the very top. And so what we've seen is that people who've been earning in the bottom part of the earnings distribution, their earnings in real terms and what their money will actually buy for them have been almost downward sloping, you know, certainly have not been going up in any way, shape, or form. And then this is true all through the middle, through the distribution until you get to the very highest and the richest people, and their earnings are going up very, very dramatically. And so one way that families have compensated is that multiple people in the family now work in order to offset this inequality. And in fact, women have experienced different kind of, women's earnings have grown more than men's even, and or at least the rate has been higher, although the levels are not quite the same yet. And as a result of this, women have not experienced as much inequality as men, in fact. And so they have, women's incomes added together with men have really, have helped families and have become really a very significant, important part of family earnings.
So let me just ask you a question about this to check my own kind of stylized fact about this, which is that since like about somewhere in the 80s, late 80s, mid 80s, almost all the income growth for the middle and bottom family income growth, not individual income growth, has been increasing participation of women in the labor force.
Yeah, that's right.
So that is how families have been compensating for the last 20 years or more.
Mm-hmm. That's right. The families have, in order to sort of keep up with rising cost of living, we're not talking about necessarily just even increasing and having more. We're talking about being able to keep up and keep the same of what they have had. They have added second incomes.
Yeah, and I think that this is, for me, an important part of the discussion, because often I think, at least when I go to like Elders Farm, for example, these discussions are about things like, oh, well, you wouldn't want to do this to get a boat or to get a big house or, you know, making those types of trade-offs. But part of what we're seeing with these economic trends is that's not the trade-off I'm seeing lots of families make. It's not about, you know, does a second person come and work? You know, it's not about, will my daughter have to work so that they can, you know, enjoy their European vacation? But it's increasingly about very basic financial stability. Can they save for retirement? Can they save for their kids to go to college? Can they, you know, afford to own a home? Those types of things. That's actually, as a parent, what makes me worried. Not so much about will my daughter be, you know, my daughter and her family be able to, you know, have some really high standard of living, but just, you know, can they cover medical expenses and those types of things.
Right. And especially unforeseen expenses, which I think leads us to our next point on uncertainty. So I think that we have this sort of belief that if you get well-educated and do everything right, that your economic life will be smooth and easy. And I think that perhaps many of us have been disabused of that notion following the Great Recession, where we saw lots of people lose their jobs who were very well-educated. And lots of people stay unemployed for much longer than they would have expected. And so a researcher at the BLS recently did a study on long-term unemployment. The BLS is the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and they produce unemployment numbers. And she followed a group of men over a course of a very long period of time, 25 years. And she looked at how many of them experienced a spell of unemployment that was as long as a year and a half. And she actually found that about 30% of them did. And this is across all types of men. So this wasn't just low educated or high educated. This is across sort of a whole big broad spectrum of men. And so I think it's actually more common than we realize or than we like to think that somebody in a family is going to experience unemployment at some point over their course of their adult working life. There's going to be a gap in earnings.
Yeah.
And so this level of uncertainty, I think, has been going up and sort of increases the need for families to have plans for what to do in these cases.
Yeah, and I, you know, the thing that I would add to this is it's a little bit different. There have been some changes about benefits, but until very recently, sometimes people would have one job that would have health benefits, sometimes they wouldn't. And I've known quite a few families where they actually split this so that, you know, one of the people stay at their jobs literally because they have good benefits.
Yeah.
And they need that job to have good benefits. And the other person would have a very hard time replicating those types of benefits somewhere else. And so just to have basic medical benefits and other types of good benefits, it was just so much more uncertain about that. Where before, all firms used to provide it. It used to be kind of came with even, you know, middle tier jobs. But more and more, the middle tier jobs have been cutting those types of, you know, those types of benefits. And so many families are out there with both people working so that they can, again, provide a very basic standard of living. Like the idea that you can have medical expenses, that you can afford to take your kids to the doctors when they need to go and they need to, or take care of yourself when you need to go. And I think that's still a worry for a lot of families.
Yeah, for sure. I think that, I think for many, many, many years, our ancestors knew as women that they had to add economic value to their families. And in the past, they helped run the farm and they sewed all the clothes and they baked the food. And there was nowhere to get those things. If you didn't have some member of your family who could sew your clothes, it was extraordinarily expensive to have your clothes made for you. Only the very, very rich did that. And so the economic value that a woman added by those things was enormous. Nowadays, unfortunately, it's difficult to add economic value to your family by sewing clothes. It's nothing to say that that's not a wonderful thing to do, but cloth is almost more expensive than buying the clothes at Target or someplace else. And so those more traditional methods of adding economic value have unfortunately become a little harder. This is mostly due to globalization and the fact of things can be made very cheaply in China, and unfortunately, that labor is cheaper than the cost, the opportunity cost of you doing it yourself. And so this has made it a challenge, I think, for women to figure out, well, how do I add economic value to my family when some of the more traditional methods are no longer carry the same economic weight? And they're not to say that they're bad things, aren't good to do. They're just not going to help your family economically as much as they used to.
So I know lots of people who, for example, and very good friends who, you know, they're trying to make the urban farm work or make the farm work. And it turns out, like, they're very well prepared. Like, these people are very well prepared. They've thought about it for a long time. They planned well. And it's actually very difficult to do it. Like, they might get there. Like, I have high hopes for them that they're going to get there and make it work. But like you say, it's no longer, you just can't go out and do that. Like, it's very, very difficult to do, you know, in that sense. And especially when your opportunity cost is getting trained in a, you know, a profession or a skill, you know, in a labor market that, you know, will reward you with cash. And it turns out cash, as all economists know, cash is pretty good because you can turn it into lots of things.
Exactly. You can choose whatever you want.
It's very flexible.
Right. Which I think maybe brings us to our next point about skill and sort of how we see skill as being the crucial key to a woman adding economic value to her family while still having time to do things she really values, like spend time with her children. And there, I think, are sort of my personal experience is very much that skill was enormously beneficial when it came time for me to bargain with my employer. So I went to school for a lot of years and transitioned eventually at the end of school into a job. And when I had a child, I didn't want to work 40 hours a week and be gone that much, but I was willing to be gone some amount of time. And so I was able to say to my employer, look, if I walk out the door, you've got to train a brand new person and replace me. And at this point, I've got some institutional knowledge. Like, how about we cut some sort of deal? You won't have as much of me, but you'll have some of me, and I will get some time at home. And I also worked for the government where that was the family work-life balance is respected perhaps a little more than in some parts of the private sector. But that was a trade-off I was happy to make, to have a little more time at home. I'm paid less than I would be as an economist in the private sector, but at this point in my life, that's fine. Again, it's not about me having a vote. It's about me contributing some economic value to my family, keeping my skills current, having an outlet for that side of me, and while still being able to spend a significant amount of time with my children. So when my children were little, I worked 2 days a week. I had a rule they could call me if they needed me urgently, but they were pretty respectful and really only called when it was urgent. And
as your kids or your employer?
No, my employer. My kids were not respectful. They wanted me all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
But and then as my kids got older, I've added more hours on, and I now work many more hours than 16, but I still have flexibility so that I am able to chaperone my kids' field trip or do the things that my kids need me to do. And that is possible because I have some skills that these employers value. And I don't actually think that skills always have to involve a PhD or a really fancy degree. I think that the secret to adding economic value to your family is just to develop a skill that you can sell to people, something that other people can't do that you can do that's in demand. So that could be music lessons, which in my area are extremely in demand and command very good money. And if you have a skill to play the piano, you can make good money on a per hour basis teaching piano lessons. Also, many sort of health things. So there's a lot of skills. People develop skills around childbirth or being doulas, things like that. People develop skills teaching all kinds of things, be it art or exercise or those sorts of things. If you can develop a skill in a math or science field, particularly if you're willing to be a computer programmer, you can pretty much write your own ticket. You can choose your hours and get paid very, very well per hour. And if you can be productive and get a lot done, you will always be in demand.
Yeah. And I mean, our personal experience was a little bit like this, and Martha even mentioned it. So when I was getting my PhD, so this goes under the uncertainty of income. Like, I went from making, you know, pretty good money to going back to a PhD program to get more education, which PhD programs pay you almost no money. Well, a little bit. But, you know, this was a chance where my wife was able to step in, and she became a childbirth instructor. And it took a while for her to build the business. But, like, we basically figured that after a while, when she got very good at it, she got lots of referrals, you know, she was, you know, making a good $50 an hour doing that. And at one point, you know, that was a good third of our income, maybe, like, enough to get us and our four kids. Me and my four kids, thank you, Liz, by the way, through my later PhD program. And an interesting anecdote that I've learned, and I talked with Martha about this a little bit, is what's so interesting to me is that so many women are doing these types of things, either entrepreneurial type of things, or working in these situations, but they don't talk about it so much. So, you know, I was talking to a friend who lives in and around Provo in the Utah Valley area, and they were telling this story about this bishop who decided he wanted to, like, survey the women of the ward, and so he did. And as an afterthought, he basically threw in this question about, you know, do you do any work outside the home for, like, money? And he just threw it in. He's like, oh, there'll just be a few who did this. And they got the results back, and it was something like between 30 and 40% of the women in Utah County were, you know, said in the survey, yes, I'm working for money in some capacity outside of the home. And he was shocked. And I don't know if we should be shocked by that number, but almost more shocking to me is just how could 30 or 40, this be going on in one of our communities where 30 or 40% of women are doing this, but no one knows. And I think there's a theory that, like, they don't want to talk about it very much.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think we feel like we all supposed to fit this stereotype. I think we all want to try to appear like we have it together and our families are perfect and that I think, you know, sometimes I've kind of chuckled because people have sort of insinuated that they thought my husband maybe didn't make very much money because I had to work, you know, and I think maybe we don't want to cast shame on our husbands, you know. I think there's lots of reasons why we're worried about this, but I actually have found that as I have sort of just been matter of fact about this as part of who I am, that I've encountered amongst my fellow women in my release study, I've encountered very little prejudice or bias, and the people have been very open to it. And in fact, it's often helped me to build connections with people who were in a different life situation than me. They were not married with kids, but once they realized that I too had a job, they thought that maybe we had more in common, and it allowed me to build a lot of bridges and make connections with people who felt like, oh, I was the only one working, and then they discovered they weren't.
Yeah. In sociology, we kind of call this like the audience effect, right? It's us thinking about what we think other people are going to think about us or about a situation. And so we say, oh, well, I'm projecting what I think people are going to think about this, and then we don't say anything. But then when we do, it turns out they think something completely different.
That's right.
But that effect can be strong enough that it can like cause this entire third order effect of silence over these types of issues. And I know one thing that we're trying to do at Aspiring Mormon Women is, you know, kind of break down that barrier and say, hey, it's okay to talk about these things, right? It's okay to talk about that I work, that you know, what happens to me at work, and you know, it's part of who I am, or this is why I do it.
I think that one thing, too, is I think often we want to teach our girls to aspire to be mothers, and I agree with that, and I think that is important, and I we don't want to downplay that crucial role. Sort of being a mother is the most amazingly demanding, crazy, hardest job I have ever done, but also far and away the most rewarding and meaningful. And as I always tell my husband, even the days when I feel like I visibly fail as a mother, I believe I'm failing at something very important. whereas my other job, you know, my paid employment, I sometimes don't always have that feeling that what I'm doing is as important. But I think, I think it's possible to aspire to do both things. And I think it's possible to aspire to add economic value to your family, and it's possible to aspire to be a mother. And I think we do our children a great service, both our sons and daughters, by showing that example and by teaching them that, because I think then whatever comes to them in life, hopefully they at least get some of that, right? Ideally, all of our children have the opportunity to get married and to have families and to have that fulfilling aspect of life. But if not, at least they hopefully get an opportunity to have a meaningful career. And for people who go a less traditional route with a career, who have them, you know, take time off or do... They get to have families, but that doesn't mean they have to give up all their aspirations to do other things, that they can sort of hopefully have a long life and do some of everything. And so I think I don't see the two as in conflict, and I think that when we get to that point, when it's okay for our daughters to aspire to both, then I think we will start to reach a new equilibrium where people are making the choices they make because that's what works for them personally, not out of a cultural or social expectation, but because either the economic circumstances are such that they have no choice, but at least they're prepared to deal with it, and that lessens the conflict and the anxiety and the difficulty of the situation a little bit because they're prepared. Or if things work out well economically and you have a lot of choice, you can really do what's best for you personally and your family personally.
Yeah. And what I find interesting always about these discussions is, you know, for... As a Mormon guy, like, this conflict isn't even a conflict, right? It's like we're expected to aspire to be good fathers and aspire in whatever we do in our career. And, you know, we talk about sometimes that there's tension between the two, that we need to, you know, balance those things. But never is it the idea that those things are completely incompatible. It's not a question of are they compatible. It's a question of, oh, well, of course, but how do you make them compatible, right? How do you balance priorities? Because I would say the exact same thing, right, that being a father is the most difficult job that I have. It's what I consider most important. It's something that when when I fail, at least I feel like I'm failing at something important. And yes, many parts of my job, I fail at, the stakes are not nearly as high as what you do in the home. But, you know, I think, you know, those types of discussions are ones that I think we can have across both those father-mother lines and maybe bring them a little bit closer together. So now I want to just end by talking a little bit about what you actually do to, or what we actually do to try to raise our daughters to be aspiring. Like, you know, in some sense, it can be very, very concerning to, like, see these big economic trends. Like, I worry about them. I study them. I think about them a lot. You know, so the question is, well, you know, what can we do for our girls? How can we help them? So I'm curious, Martha, do you have any strategies that you use with your daughter?
I mean, I think that I place such a high priority on teaching my children skills, both my kids, both my sons and daughters, and that my job as a mother is educator in chief, right? And if my children arrive at adulthood without, you know, if they arrive at age 30 and they do not have a marketable skill, I think I'll feel like a real failure as a mom. And so I think sort of modeling the, you know, to acquire skill, no child does this, I think, automatically, because acquiring skill is just all really about hard work. Some natural talent is always helpful, but the overwhelming majority of people who are successful are just successful because they work very, very hard. And so I think teaching our children, you know, especially our daughters, I think girls are often very afraid of failure. They're really scared when they get things wrong. They think that means they're stupid. They don't, and I think sometimes, at least in my children, I observe that my son is a little better at saying, okay, well, I didn't know that. I got it wrong. Let me learn that. Okay, now I know that. I won't make the mistake again. And sort of teaching kids how to acquire skill, not just helping them to get a skill, but how to get skills. And giving our daughters confidence that they really can go out and get any skill that they need or want to get. They can go out and do it. And also, the other thing is to not be too afraid of the tradition, you know, that when I was first at the Census Bureau, people told me, we don't know anybody that works part-time at the Census Bureau, you know, and I had a lot of people tell me, like, oh, if you take time off with the PhD, you know, like, this is going to be so detrimental to you, and it, you know, you just got to not worry about that. When you're in the position where you're ready to make the decision, you know that what you want to do is work X number of hours. It doesn't matter if you're the first person on the planet who's ever proposed that to your boss. You go in and you say, this is why this works for you, and this is why this works for me. Let's give this a try. What's the worst they can do? Say no. Well, then you're not any worse off, because then you quit, or you don't quit and you work full time, but you're no worse off for having asked, I don't think. And so I think too often as women, we allow ourselves to be sort of pigeonholed by what we see around us happening. We got to think outside the box. And teaching our daughters, like, okay, so your advisor says this is the only way to do it. Don't believe him. You know, like, that's nonsense. You know, you do what you want to do and it's going to be fine. And I really, really believe that. When you follow your own path that you know is right for you, it works out. Not necessarily, not to say they're not trade-offs. You're not going to give some things up. But it's going to work out that you're going to be happy and that your family's going to be happy. Yeah.
Just some interesting sociology on this, which is exactly what you're saying, which is, there's a different way in which we talk to boys and girls, and we don't even realize it, and it tends to be subtle. And one of the ways in which we do is that we praise boys for hard work, but we tend to praise girls for their attributes, being smart or being pretty.
Being pretty, yeah.
Being pretty is a big one, but being smart too. And actually, one of the things that we know from sociology is that when you praise someone for hard work, and what that does is that gives them this idea of grit, that, you know, what's important is the effort that I put in.
Right.
And we do, and we say things like, oh, you know, that was a really great effort. Good, you know, good job, good try. You know, but when we praise only on attributes, and again, we don't do it in a mean-spirited way at all. When we say, oh, you're smart, then when they hit an obstacle, they internalize that as, oh, it's not that I need to work harder, it's I'm not smart.
I'm dumb.
and then they pull back.
Right.
They pull back from this.
Because then they say, I'm not good at that. I'm not going to do that.
Yes. And so this is actually one of the prevailing theories as to why there's such a big difference between the persistence of women and men in things like the STEM fields, mm-hmm. is exactly this reason. Because the boys are taught over and over again through all these small interactions that It's if you didn't get it the first time, you just go back and do it again. And you can do it, and you can learn how to do it. But by all this attribute stuff, this is one of the reasons why the girls say, oh, I fail. And of course, when you don't fail at something, the way in which you manage that identity is you say, I don't like it.
Right?
You're like, because we none of us like things that we fail at. Right. And we tend to always like things that we're considered successful at. And so I've tried to be very much more conscious with how I speak to my daughters, especially. And early on, I totally caught myself. First thing, when I say to any girl, not just my daughters, like, oh, you're so pretty, right? Or you look so nice, or something like that. Instead, I try to say, oh, it's like, wow, you know, you look like you work really hard, or it looks like you put a lot of effort into that. And just those small changes make a big difference,
yeah,
it turns out, in how you do it. So that's one thing that I've tried to do that.
Yeah, no, that's exactly where I am with my 8-year-old, who is telling me that she thinks she's bad at math. And I'm like, there's no bad or good. You're not born bad or good. You choose to be good or bad by how hard you want to try and how often you want to repeat it till you understand it. That's all it is. It's just repeating it over and over until you get it. And so I think that is the crucial. And I think we have to model for girls respect for skill. You know, when we see women around us who have skills, and those don't need to necessarily be skills being used in the workplace, but anytime we see a woman with a skill, we can highlight for our daughters, she learned how to do that because she spent however long doing this over and over and over, and look what she can do now, you know. And when we could point to the older teenagers in our ward and say, look, you know, look at her. She's now learned to do this because she spent so long doing it. So a great respect, I think, for skill. And then just talking honestly about money with our daughters, I think, is super, super important. And explaining that, the way to get ahead in life is to work hard, save a little bit, put a little bit away, and that everybody contributes to that in whatever way. And so that family finances can be a discussion with both our sons and our daughters. So the daughters don't view it as money is something the man worries about and the wife's job is just to spend it all. Like, that's not the way it works, right? Everybody's involved in contributing economically to the family and then making decisions about how to spend money.
And at least for me, you know, the way that I just always want to set the expectation for my daughter that she should just expect that she's going to work at something. I mean, she might end up in a situation where she will have the luxury to choose not to work. Totally could happen, and it could be the right situation for her. But if you set that as the expectation, like that's the way it's going to be, you know, or what you should expect, or that's what the good outcome is, it doesn't give you a fallback option. Where this way, what you expect is, oh, I'm always going to work. I'm always going to be thinking about doing something. I'm being raised as an idea of what do you want to be when you grow up? Like, what are your dreams? Like, we need to continue to have those conversations and have those, at least for me, conversations be predominant, especially when they're young. Because, I mean, honestly, at 12, they need to be worried about what they do next in school, and they need to be worried about high school, and then they need to be worried about college. And you know, parenthood is something that we want to always emphasize as being important, but that's for everyone. But it's definitely not the next thing in their life, and we just don't know when it's ever going, you know, if it's going to come or ever going to come. And so, but we all know that no matter what you do, you have to work in some capacity, mm-hmm. right? You have to be productive.
And I think we just have to continually reassure our daughters that it doesn't have to be an either or choice. You know, I know that was for me when I was in college and I hit the point where I was really making the decision about what was I going to do after college. And I remember being really, really greatly distressed about this because to me, I didn't know very many women who did both. And my own mother was one of the few people I knew who combined both a career and a family. She had 5 kids. She worked part-time for many years. She eventually worked full-time at the end of her life. But she, you know, and so I really turned to her for advice. And she was like, you can do both. She's like, and She goes, you can't plan it all out exactly in advance. You're going to have to take it step by step and see when the opportunity presents itself. You're still single. You don't know when you're going to get married and have kids. She said, but it's not. You do want to plan to have children, and you want to aspire to that. But you can work it out so that you can also do these other things that you like. Don't give up on those things. And right now, since you're single, focus on getting that done, you know? And that's the other thing. Like, you know, if you have daughters who get married later or whatever, that's not a cause for panic. That's a cause, invest. Use that time while you've got it. Like, if you are still single and still looking for the right life partner for yourself, then that is the crucial time to invest as much as you can, both, you know, in your education, but also in a career. If you can get a couple of years of working in, then you have so many opportunities for part-time, for these really great work things. And so I think don't view those as wasted years. Just view them as this is the time I have to invest, and then this will be a great help to my family down the road.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I've been thinking about what I'm going to counsel my daughters and my sons when they kind of hit those ages where, you know, marriageable ages and those types of things. And I put a lot of thought at this, and this is my view. I'm sure it's not everyone's view. You know, which is, you know, I'm really agnostic about the age at which my daughters get married. You know, some people would be like, oh, if you get married too early, you know, then you could get, you know, that could be a problem. For me, I mean, I got married young, probably from my own experience. Like, my wife and I got married young at 21. We were like, you know, the normal, got home from the mission, you know, the whole story. But you know, one thing my mother actually told me when we got married, and a piece of advice I really appreciated, was she's like, you know, you don't have to worry about having kids right away. It's like, don't feel so bad about that, because you've got so much to do. You've got, you know, a relationship to build. You've got investments to make. And I think I'm going to tell my daughter the same thing, which is, when the right person comes along, sure, like, get married. Like, getting married to the right person is more important than when you get married, whether it's early or late.
Yep.
But either way, you know, that decision about how you invest in your career for a few years to create options for yourself, a stable financial base, all those types of things, like, it can be separate from that decision about when to have children. And I think that's, these days, that's a pretty common way to think, but one that I want to make sure my daughter is thinking about, right, is that those are very separate decisions, and thinking about one's economic viability and stability because of these economic trends are something that I want her to think very carefully about when she makes those decisions, because you don't know what's going to happen in 5 years, right? But what we do know is if you've invested in skill and you've invested in a career, not just in education, you're going to have options, you know, if something happens to the family, if there's a spell of unemployment, if you know, it becomes hard for your partner to get a job that can sustain the family by themselves. If you want a flexible career, the one thing we know is education today is not enough. A degree is not enough.
Not one that sits on a shelf.
No.
For 10 years, yeah. And, you know, and I think I would say something similar to my daughter, you know, find the right, make the decision at the right point for you. And I think the decision about when to have kids is very, very personal and different for everybody. And I've seen so many people do it so many different ways. And I think all ways can work well. If you do it with open eyes, know what you're doing, what you're getting yourself into, and recognize that there are some financial realities that are going to come, you know? And if you decide to have children earlier and that means you still need to work for a while you have those kids, that's a completely doable thing. And many people make that work. And if you feel like you can take some time off that early, you know, I think if I had a daughter who got married really early and decided to have kids really young, I would tell her, hold off on grad school. You're going to be 30 and have a 10-year-old. That's the perfect time to go back and get a graduate degree. And, you know, you might just have to retool up the education a little bit down the road. I don't think that's a bad alternative. Like, maybe that suits your lifestyle. Having children young is better biologically for you.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that. You have both you and the baby will have better outcomes. So, you know, if my daughter feels like she wants to have children young, I will be opposed to that. I'll just say, okay, so you do this now. You're going to recognize that you're going to be very young when your children are out of the house. And then you're going to need to think about what you want to do for the next 30 years, because you will be working until you're 70. We all will be working until we're 70.
Yeah.
So if your kids go to college when you're 40, great time for you to go back to school.
It's like 30 years.
And then you've got plenty of time to work after that.
Yeah.
So I think that you know, there are lots and lots of different ways to make it work. The point is absolutely, at some point, you've got to have skill and you've got to go get work experience. And you've got to be planning for those things. And you really, it's just not going to happen from the overwhelming majority of us that age 50 as a woman, we are going to be economically in a position where we are not going to need to add any economic value to our family. Those people are going to be rarer and rarer.
Yeah. And that's right where my wife and I are now. We have four kids. They're all in school. And we did the sequencing thing. We had our kids young. We had them compacted. Mm-hmm. Retroactively, sense-making, we'd say, oh, we planned it. I'm not sure exactly that that's true, but we like to pretend it is. You know. But now my wife has options about, you know, how to invest in going forward. And even though we're about 40, that's 30 years.
That's a long time, even though,
like, on-ramping, I mean, let's be clear about something, which is the institutional systems for on-ramping are not yet built. They're getting better. People are working hard to make them better, but it's hard.
Yes.
And I think our experience and many of the women we know is hard, but it's doable. And if you just start doing something, 30 years is a long time. You know, I mean, that's less time than I've been building my career now. So from 30 years from now, we'll be something.
Yeah. No, it's still a long time. And I really think, you know, if the first thing you want to do when your kids all are in kindergarten, go back to community college even. Like, don't be, you know, I know a woman who, a wife of a colleague who stayed home with children, and then she could foresee her kids were going to be all out of the house, and she wanted to start her own business in home interior design. And she didn't have certification she needed, so she went back to community college, and she just took one class at a time. Now her youngest is about to go to kindergarten. She's launched her business. There are so many ways you can make this work.
Yeah.
And it's just all about a little foresight, a little bit of realization that this is going to need to be a part of your life, and then looking for something that you can enjoy doing that provides some economic value.
Yeah, I totally agree. So I don't know if you have anything else. I think I pretty much covered what was on my list to talk about. The world is changing, and the fact is, in 10 years, I don't even know what it's going to like. Some of these trends might have reversed. We might make headway on reducing inequality. There might be better middle-class jobs that come up. You know, maybe flexibility will be expanded much more broadly than it is. I think more broadly than it is now. Maybe we'll do a little bit of better job of risk sharing than I think we're doing right now. Those things may all happen. I don't want to bet on that world. You know, I want to bet on my daughters.
I think I would agree. There's absolutely no way to know what will happen to economic trends. And certainly we've seen times in our country, so there was this level of inequality in the 1890s, and it reversed itself. You know, by the 1950s, we'd reached a period of actually relative great equality. They're still rich and poor, but the gap was not very large. And so we could see a reversal like that. One thing I feel confident in is that what we call a job in 10 years from now will not necessarily look much like the jobs our parents held, and may not even look very much like the jobs we currently hold. The workplace is changing very rapidly with technology and automation, and the need to be in a physical location and do something is really changing. And I am really optimistic that that is going to be to the great benefit of women. And that the ability
families.
You're absolutely right. But both the men and women will greatly benefit from the ability to not have to be tied as much to a physical location in terms of work. And so, I think that big changes are coming down the road in that, and it'll be really interesting what they are. I bet we won't guess them all. And so I think it's just all a matter of staying on top of it and planning for the future.
Yeah.